But Jackson sat pouting on his slave farm, complaining that he was cheated out. Fosters, damn, there's some irony there. You're sitting on a farm with your 150 slaves thinking that you were cheated out of something.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the Western Massachusetts to Eric's West Virginia. Take me home. And today is all about compromises. Definitely nothing controversial or stress-inducing today, right, Eric?
No. It's good. I took all my blood pressure medication.
It's all compromises. Everything's going to be nice and lovely. Handshakes. We're all going to be making deals and happy with each other, right?
Yeah. All factual-based. It's going to be absolutely not just a crazy slave-owning person getting angry at the world because he didn't win. So we're going to talk about the corrupt bargain, all right, which isn't corrupt. There's actually no evidence to support the corrupt bargain. And to the point where James Buchanan, the guy who's the reason the Civil War started and is arguably the worst president ever, he was the one actually bargaining behind the scenes in favor for Jackson. But let's start before the corrupt bargain.
Yeah, so should say something about this being part four of our John Quincy Adams series, and that if you wanted to check out the rest of the stuff that we've done, which is pre, post, and during his presidencies in parts 1, 2, and 3, you can do that by checking out the playlist that'll be linked in the show notes right below. But, okay, Eric, with all that out of the way, now, please, tell us what's going on.
So angry. I'm so upset. I need to breathe again. Ooh, I need to breathe again
because I can tell. That's why I interrupted you. I could see the vessel like pumping on your forehead.
Like, I'm happy you did that, Kyle, because it actually let me regear myself so I can stop being as angry. So today we're going to be talking about the election of 1824, horribly named and taught in schools the corrupt bargain, where there was literally no evidence that John Adams did anything corrupt. Also, you can look at his entire history of a human being of literally never doing anything corrupt. And instead, you had Jackson's team was the one to try and do the corrupt bargain, led by James Buchanan, also known as the worst American president. I think he's worse than Andrew Johnson. I'm willing to argue that the guy who started the Civil War and just was a horrible human being in general was worse. But Kyle, I want to talk about some interesting thing I learned. You know, Andrew Jackson won the majority of the popular vote, but as we all know, so it was about 155,000 for Jackson and 110,000 for Adams. There were some other people who ran at the time. We'll get into them in a sec. But as we know, the United States is a republic. So what don't we do? We don't have direct democracy, direct elections for our presidents. It's electoral college votes. Now, electoral college is based on not voters, but population. And as we all know, we had the 3/5 compromise in 1787 that said, even though all the people obviously didn't think they were humans who were advocating for the 3/5 compromise, they also still wanted them to be recognized as humans so it could help the political career. So Jackson argued that he had the most electoral college vote. He had 99 to John Quincy Adams, 84. If Jackson didn't, you know, if he actually, if his electoral base looked like what he thought, which is that he thought slaves weren't people, what if they didn't count? What if they didn't count electoral college vote?
Probably lost it by the same margin, I would guess.
Yeah, he lost it. He lost. So he wasn't in first place. He had 99 electoral college votes, and he would have fallen to 81. He would have lost over 20% of his electoral college votes. But in fairness, John Quincy Adams would have lost, let me check, zero. He had 84, and he would have had 84 afterwards. The biggest hypocrite of anybody who's ever run for office, and I will argue this to this day, is Andrew Jackson. I don't fully understand why this dude was... I know in modern times he's not lauded at all. I always love every year when they come out that we see presidential rankings, John Quincy Adams gets a little higher and Andrew Jackson keeps getting a little lower. And I'm like, one day they're going to pass each other.
Yeah.
And I think at that day, John Quincy Adams, $20 bill. Let's go. Andrew Jackson.
Oh,
paper,
yeah.
Paper money. So if I become president, it's literally my only thing I'm going to do. I'm just going to just pick John Quincy Adams, $20 bill. So we'll take a step back and talk about the election of 1824. It was a very contentious election, obviously, but it featured four very prominent candidates. You had John Quincy Adams out of Massachusetts. You had Andrew Jackson out of Tennessee. you know, the celebrated hero of New Orleans for his 1815 victory against the British in a war that ended in 1814. So that's interesting. It's not really a military victory if it's done. That's just a skirmish. I don't know
what you call that.
We had the Speaker of the House running, Henry Clay. So you had the Monroe Secretary of State running. You had a very prominent senator and general. You had Henry Clay, who was the Speaker of the House. And then you had the Secretary of Treasury under Monroe, which was William Crawford, who very famously would roll his eyes so much at John Quincy Adams that he had to take notes of it.
It's another short.
And we also had John C. Calhoun out of South Carolina. But, you know, he didn't really have national support. No, so, yeah, so to just break down platform for each, John Quincy Adams, Federalist style of government, even though these are all Democratic Republicans, essentially, at the time, but believed in a strong federal government. He came with this, like, you know, part of it was like, oh, he's a Northeasterner who have always been off-putting. But he's seen as like this brilliant diplomat, Treaty of Ghent, you know, son of a founding father, all this stuff. So he's seen a little differently in light. And he's also seen as this ultra competent politician, like crazy, hilariously competent. Yeah. Arguably the best resume of any president who's ever run. Like, nominated Supreme Court unanimously, served as a senator, you know, served as Secretary of State.
The Monroe Doctrine.
But don't forget, people didn't know he wrote that at the time. It would be right. A little after his death. He's just seen as a different level, even though he's a Northeasterner, and Northeasterners are hard to get elected in general. Andrew Jackson, he's kind of forging his own way of this kind of weird proto-populism that would kind of really explode 4 years later. But, you know, he's looking for a lot of newly enfranchised white male voters, really like him. He has this outside image. He's considered blunt and gave a voice to democracy, you know, that's... you know, wanted to be asserted, and, you know, he was very distrustful. He's anti-establishment terrorist with a populist background. You got Henry Clay. Henry Clay, kind of interesting dude. You know, he dominates, he's from Kentucky, dominates the Western bloc, charismatic. He's an orator. He believes he's architect of the American system. You know, he favored protectionism. He liked national banks. He wanted federal investment. He's, you know, very... very, very popular in, like, the American West. You know, he's from Kentucky, the Kentucky area. He's a war hawk during the War of 1812. But he consolidated this crazy power base in Congress. He's basically, like, the most powerful congressman of all time, I think would be a good way to describe him. But he was very focused, very similar to Adams, on national unity. And that's going to come back. That's going to come back later on in this, where he basically viewed the role of government, that it should... try and, you know, that if you're elected to federal government, you should try and serve at a federal level. What a weird concept. Then you had William Crawford. William Crawford, he's from Georgia. He's, you know, he was the Secretary of Treasury under Monroe. He was actually the official nominee of the Democratic Republican Party, but it didn't really matter at this point. He was part of something called the old Republicans, which are this, like, really conservative wing of the Democratic Republican Party that favored limited government. But he suffered a stroke in 1823 that left him partially incapacitated, and it really derailed his political campaign. Though people still, you know, still really caucused for him. he wasn't completely unpopular. And the dark horse at the time would later become Vice President John C. Calhoun from South Carolina, incredibly pro-slavery. Like, it was a big part of his platform. But he, you know, very quickly realized he had no national support. South Carolinians weren't super popular at this time, and for a couple different reasons, they didn't really have a strong voting bloc, and so he stepped out very early in the election. So,
but then now, did he team up with John Adams? That seems like a weird alliance.
Well, he was the previous vice president, so he was. Oh, sorry, he was the previous Secretary of War, so he was a holdover that he nominated for vice president.
Although that does seem like something John Quincy Adams would do from just a morality standpoint, was put someone in to check him.
That's exactly why he kept these people around.
Yeah.
He was like, you're good at your job, you're serving the nation well, let me keep you around.
That sounds like a real meritocracy.
Oh, yeah, because he is. Because he is actually, he did this weird thing, unlike all the other three people running. Actually, I think, I forget Henry Clay's view. Henry Clay had a different view on slavery than the other three guys I mentioned, so I don't want to be careful of that. But basically he was like, oh, meritocracy, you mean the thing I did and my dad did? Andrew right. Jackson's like, well, I built myself up. Ignore the people I have in captivity.
A just big strong myself man. And a $5 million loan from my dad.
Yeah. So no candidate won any electoral majority. So it broke down like this. We had, as we mentioned earlier, the 99 electoral votes for Andrew Jackson, which would have been 81 if Andrew Jackson agreed with his own view of people. Right. He wins 52,000% of the vote, which is 42% of the popular vote. Adams wins 84 electoral votes, 114,000 total votes, around 32%. And then we have everybody else is far behind. You have Crawford at 41, which is crazy given Crawford's health that he still got 41.
Yeah. Does he even talk? Could he even talk at this point?
I did read accounts that he was still giving speeches, so I want to say yes, but I do believe he had limited speech. You're right on that, Kyle. And then Clay got 37 votes, and you know Clay got another three, but at this point, Clay carried three states. Clay had 37 votes, carrying three states. I don't know why I said that way.
Those three states were all his mom did.
So right now you needed to finish with 31 electoral votes to win the presidency. So nobody was remotely close.
Wait, you needed how many?
You needed 131.
Okay, I thought you said 31.
Like, I probably did. Okay, 131 votes to declare the presidency. So nobody's remotely close. Now the 13th Amendment, which was passed in 1804, outlined what was to happen in this case. It was to go. There would be a contingent election in the House of Reps, and this is the first time since 1800 that the president would be decided in the House, according to this amendment rule. So after this happens, you get the amendment's rules say that only the three top electoral college vote getters could be considered by the House. So Henry Clay, who finished fourth, was immediately eliminated. Right. So it left it to Jackson, Adams, and Crawford. Now Crawford was no chance. Crawford is winning. Well, who is the Speaker of the House? Henry Clay. Mm-hmm. So Henry Clay, you know, ends up convening the House for a vote. You know, it's this is like, you know, we're in early 1825 right now. We're in January, and he convenes the House, and you know, they start having discussions. Now, what's important is that the Jackson camp argues this is when the corrupt bargain happens. That Adams approaches Clay and says, "Hey, I'll make you Secretary of State," which is essentially the step before being president at this point in history, if you give me your support. Mm-hmm. The problem with that logic, which is very ironic, is at the same time James Buchanan is going around pushing people to vote for Jackson. Like, this wasn't a vote; they were literally trying to do their own corrupt bargain.
Like, sounds like whipping.
Yeah, it's like whipping, but illegal.
Right.
But Clay, at this point, had never talked in any sort of elective capacity to Adams. The problem is, Clay hated Jackson. Mm-hmm. They loathed each other. They differed on politics. You had Jackson, this outsider who believed in state rights. You had Clay, who very famously was a nationalist. Like, not nationalist in the modern day sense. I'm saying nationalist as he believed in a national government. God, so many of the times in the show we have to like qualify.
I have to change the terms. Yeah, right. I'm a Federalist.
And his opinions on the national economy were very in line with Adams, like almost to a T. You know, and so it wasn't really this surprise when, mm-hmm. I mean, it's very logical that Clay threw his support behind Jackson. Clay threw his support behind Adams. But then it got a little weird. So Crawford bowed out, essentially. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his allies, you know, kind of came back and were like, hey, you're in really bad health, dude. And what are we going to do here? So they end up splitting off. And when they end up splitting off, it creates this weird, I almost want to say, powered economy. Now, what's important to understand is that the states aren't voting. Like, each member of the House doesn't vote, and then it's the total. Each state votes for one candidate, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what ends up happening about is that I want to make sure I word this right, because I have a quote from a book here. All right, so the thing I took this from is like a book written like 1911. So it reads really
awkward. Yeah,
it's very awkward the way they word. All right, so by January 8th, 1825, Clay starts. We start to have evidence, right? We first hear accounts. So Clay confides in his friends that he would support Adams, even knowing it might be, as future 8th president Martin Van Buren quipped, his political death warrant in the South and West. Clay accepted that risk, and later writing that he chose the course based on his conscience, even if it cost him his popularity. Henry Clay's a cool dude. He's a really interesting dude. Cousin is Cassius Clay, like the guy.
So I was wondering about that. Really?
Yeah. Cassius Clay is one of the best American side characters of all time. Just super, super abolitionist. What ends up happening behind the scenes is a lot of this very intense lobbying comes from the Jackson camp, and people actually start approaching Jackson. There was a story circulating, firsthand story. In Washington at the time, that Jackson's intermediaries actually approached Clay's camp, kind of hinting that Jackson may consider making Clay Secretary of State if Clay would support him.
Right.
Which is funny, because that's the same lie they came up with this for John Quincy Adams.
Interesting.
Yeah, right? Is that weird that you accuse the person of doing what you did? I think that's like one of those things you do for disinformation.
Obviously, he couldn't have done it because the other guy did it first. Right?
Yeah.
It's not my fault if you did it first. He beat me to it.
So on February 9th, 1825, they hold the vote for the top three candidates. Each state got one vote, and with an absolute majority of states, so 13 out of 24 states at the time, needed to win. And so Henry Clay endorses Adams, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes canvassing for John Quincy Adams, and he won on the first ballot. He won 13 states on the first ballot. So immediately. Now you're probably saying, oh, did Jackson get 12? Jackson got 7.
No. So that's even close.
He got 7. He barely got halfway there.
Right.
Like Crawford. He was closer to Crawford at 4. The stroke guy who wasn't in good health, whose own delegation abandoned him. And he got the states. So let's just talk about the states for a minute. He got his original England states. He got the six states of Union, of New England, obviously. Kentucky backed him, even though the Kentucky legislator originally told the Kentucky reps to vote for Jackson. They were like, this guy's kind of nuts, and I don't really want him being president. But Ohio and Missouri also voted for him. Illinois and Louisiana. States that Jackson carried the popular vote. Also went for Adams. Like, the people who knew...
Maybe he got a little annoyed.
I think that's an indictment on Jackson. The people who actually know were like, dude, you don't want to vote for this guy.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But you can also see why maybe he might be pointing, like, something. Collusion. He's probably just out there shouting collusion like some guy at a fantasy football league.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And Jackson would be the annoying guy in the fantasy football league who loses every year. But somehow also it's everybody else's fault.
He also carries 6 quarterbacks on his bench.
Yeah. So everything Jackson did was exactly in line with the Constitution. It was, every firsthand account. I mean, actually Politico ran a story on this. That was very good. It shows that this was, the exact way the Constitution wanted this decided. And again, it's not 13 to 12 states. Yeah. It's 13 states to 7. Like, it's...
Yeah. And 4 to a shell of a man.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, to a man who was like, please don't vote for me.
Right. Drooling.
So a journalist at the time noted Jackson's defeat, highlighted 4 crucial elements of our election system, especially the provision of the House to decide when no candidate receives an electoral majority. Which, what he meant by that was... The 4 crucial elements of our election system when no candidate receives that majority. And basically that's the focus on discernment, of the House, so allowing the House to debate it, right? It's not like there was a straw vote immediately. That the popular candidates were the candidates of choice. So the House couldn't elect like a dark horse off the
right. Yeah.
Continuity of government. In other words, like nobody's position changed relative to the vote itself. So it's not like
The vice president to president or something like that.
Yep. And it's not like Henry Clay could have stepped in there and been like, I'm actually, you know, going to be running now or anything crazy like that. Right. You know, and
I changed my name to John Adams.
And one thing I thought was very interesting, I think some of the writers at the time were very astute in acknowledging this, that the integrity of the election was known. And I think that there's a key word there, was known. Mm-hmm. Unlike you and I, when we vote, Kyle, they knew who voted for who. So this idea that they could have a secret ballot that wouldn't obligate the people who would eventually be elected or unelected by their populace, you know, fired, do people know who voted? And I think that's a huge one, that these people really stood on their morals, right? Like, you could be unelected, I mean, because of who you voted for.
Yeah.
So, immediately after this, Jackson resigns, takes his ball and goes home, like a little baby, and the Tennessee legislator immediately nominate him for the election of 1828 to run against Adams. Honestly, Jackson would run against himself. Henry Clay ends up becoming Secretary of State, and it's you know, it's everybody's upset at that, and no, it's what ends up becoming.
Did Andrew Jackson get a position in the cabinet?
Honestly, knowing Adams, he probably would have been open to having Andrew Jackson in the cabinet. But no, he's just
what would he have been qualified to do?
Nothing. Nothing. Right. Maybe fighting wars after the wars ended. Fighting battles after a war ended.
Vice president.
Honestly, vice president. Yeah, John C. Calhoun wasn't too far off. But here's where it gets really interesting. And the part where people normally stop, we stopped learning about it in school. So where does the term corrupt bargain start? It actually started in a report, in a paper called the Columbian Observer, where it published an anonymous letter that later would be confirmed to be written by Pennsylvania Congressman George Creamer. Where he was accusing Clay. Yeah, these names are amazing.
So many good names in history.
He starts accusing Clay of selling his influence to Adams. The letter claimed that Clay had made it known to both Jackson and Adams that he would support whichever one agreed to appoint him Secretary of State. And Jackson supposedly refused the idea while Adams agreed, which, again, sounds the most opposite of those two people. Like, the most opposite of those two people.
Right.
This alleged backroom deal was announced as, and I'm quoting from the paper right here, one of the most disgraceful transactions that ever covered... one of the most disgraceful transactions that ever covered with infamy the Republican ranks. And it railed against the scandalous corrupt bargain into the political discourse.
But that's just trading political capital. I don't even really see anything too wrong with that.
Yeah, Adams would see something wrong with that. Jackson would have eaten that up.
Mm-hmm.
Which he tried to do. I mean, he literally tried to do it. He tried to get his camp to do it. So Henry Clay was ticked off. He was angry about this. So he writes in the, there's this paper called the National Intelligencer. Yes, that's its actual name, Intelligencer.
The newspapers didn't get named as well as the people of the day.
No. I'm still a big fan of Dick Rush.
George Creamer.
So Henry Clay writes in this paper, and he challenged the letter writer to come forward because originally it was anonymous. Congressman George Creamer, he shows up. He's like, hey, I wrote the letter, and, you know, and proclaimed he could prove it, that he had evidence. So Clay formally asked the House of Representatives to investigate the charge, and he had bartered his vote in Congress. And a special House committee was convened in February of 1825, so the same month that Adams gets named president, to hear Kramer's evidence. Kramer actually refuses to ever testify. He immediately backs down and just never showed up that day. And when
I'm sorry, but I love that from Mr. Clay there. Like, how awesome is that? Like, oh, really? You think I did something wrong? Call a special inquiry.
Yeah.
Investigate it. Go ahead.
So then Clay's like, oh, these people are horrible. And he was so he starts calling all of them to come testify. And Jackson's allies actually asked for the hearing, asked for the special committee to be folded. And they didn't want any formal, they didn't want it formally examined. And that's because they had no proof. They literally had no proof.
Yeah. Got caught with their hand in the cookie jar.
Yeah.
Make it up. Lies.
So, you know, they end up adjourning the meeting with no evidence or anything, you know, and essentially clearing Clay of all these charges. You know,
problem is, though, the headlines are already done all the damage.
Oh, and the press would run with these headlines for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, the public perception was that, you know, it was this corrupt bargain. It was, so when, you know, he gets, President Adams gets sworn in on March 4th, 1825, a lot of people saw this as quid pro quo. You know, even though, you know, Clay, there was ample reason to for Clay to be Secretary of State. He was very well qualified. He was a nationalist. He had his nationalist vision. He was the founder of the American system, which John Quincy Adams loved. But Jackson sat pouting on his slave farm, complaining that he was cheated out. Fuster's damn, there's some irony there. You're sitting on a farm with your 150 slaves thinking that you were cheated out of something. Oh, we're not, Kyle. We're not gonna be able to do the Jackson series.
It's gonna be a tough one.
I'm not gonna be able to do it. Jackson uses the term that Henry Clay sold his soul, sold his self. And I'm like, Jackson, you are a piece. You're not a good person. No. And you know, consistently under multiple examinations, multiple letter writing, and through a myriad of history, that nobody. Adams and Clay's story made incredibly consistent. There was never any bargain. You know, he never did it. Do you know what he said after this accusation in his journal? He ended it with,
what?
Well, any event. He described what happened. He said, well, in any event, and then went on writing in his journal. Adams was like, ah, all right.
Whatever. Not even worth the ink.
Yeah. So later on, the story of the corrupt bargain is really Clay clearing his own name. He wrote this, he published
something. Did you say in the beginning we were talking about this that he did make this deal or try to make this deal with Jackson initially?
So Jackson's camp approached him.
Jackson. Jackson's. Okay.
So we have our first appearance of a later president in here, which is James Buchanan. So James Buchanan is a weird dude. He's a really, really weird dude. So James Buchanan was kind of like on the outs with Jackson early on in his career, then became a fervent Jackson supporter. So at this point, James Buchanan's like going around campaigning. He's kind of like, I can't use this term because we obviously don't want, you know, this would change the rating of this politics, but he was a easily malleable person for Jackson. Who just had big wide eyes and a sycophant, I guess you would call it, to be more politically correct for Jackson. Jackson, I don't think, liked Buchanan. Jackson and Van Buren got along. I think they liked each other. Like,
I'm surprised anybody liked Jackson.
Well, he's one of those guys where, it's just cool, tough guy persona. Then you look at him and you're like, are you? I mean, you're old hickory. So, yeah, James Buchanan's like this fanboy of Jackson, and he's going around. It seems like he was the one to approach Clay and say, hey, would you do this? And Clay's like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, like, destroy my political career. He essentially destroyed his political career to nominate John Quincy Adams, without any benefit. So Henry Clay ends up drafting this publication called Address to the Public, and he marshaled testimony refuting Jackson charges. He actually went around documenting how he had decided to support Adams before ever speaking to Adams about any office, and pointed out that Jackson allies had attempted intrigues of their own, that's the term he used, including Buchanan approach to Jackson. And he viewed that as undermining the entire process. It made him feel horrible. And in this 1827 pamphlet and follow-up 1829 supplemental pamphlet, he painstakingly rebuked the corrupt bargain. And point by point, even people who disagreed, you know, with sideline players, even people who, you know, disagreed with this type of thing being public, remarked on how well put together this pamphlet was. One of the people who remarked and called it eloquent and praising the weight of the testimony it exhibits was this guy, James Madison.
I remember him.
Yeah. James Madison was like, hey guys, I'm not really involved in either one of these. You know, the guy who was in charge of the army during the War of 1812, where Andrew Jackson got all his acclaim for, again, fighting a battle that didn't affect the war and was after the treaty was signed. I'm going to remind everybody about that all the time, that Andrew Jackson's not a war hero. You're not a war hero if you fight a war after a war ended. But I'm going to quote Joseph Postel, which is really, really interesting guy. Just read any of his stuff. He's awesome. He said, the Krupp bargain, I think, is mostly mythological. We don't have conclusive evidence that any deal was ever made. But what did exist were plenty of that was the end of the quote. But what did exist is that there was a ton of circumstantial evidence that made the accusations easy to believe, even though they were easily refutable by Clay. Yeah. And Jackson partisans boiled it down to one fact. They said, in fact, in quotation marks, Clay became the Secretary of State immediately after helping get Adam elected. And that was their proof. That was their smoking gun. Despite them not wanting to testify, despite them approaching Henry Clay for this, despite Henry Clay being incredibly popular, incredibly well-qualified to be Secretary of State, and having the same exact system of belief that Adams did, despite probably would have been easier for Henry Clay to side with Jackson, given that they were from the same area, and right. that he would have had the Crawford support. Instead, Henry Clay chose to vote on his morals, voted for the man who he thought would be best for the office, and a man who believed in the nationalistic system. And for that, because the Jacksonians are basically people who love powered economies, as the fact that they all own slaves, did not like the idea of somebody not bending to their will. Instead, Henry Clay made a moral decision to pick the most qualified person for the role, and he picked Adams. It's really hard to believe that Adams is not the most qualified president of all time. Yeah. It is really hard to not see what Henry Clay was coming from. And on top of that, he was a man who knew Jackson. He was scared of Jackson, how cantankerous, how angry, how war-hungry he was. And this is coming from a war hawk. Henry Clay is a war hawk. He's kind of where that term came from. And the cronies, wild. The Van Burens, the Buchanans, you're talking about some of the worst elected officials in the history of our country, crowded around this guy. And Clay saw it. Clay is one of the greatest, if not the greatest speaker of the House, definitely one of the greatest speakers, saw these disgusting humans and was like, wait a minute, if you have a poop platform and you hang out with poop people, you're going to start smelling. Like, that's just a simple fact. And those guys wouldn't go and sit in front of Congress, wouldn't go show their evidence, showed they were sycophants. Showed that they just love the smell of Andrew Jackson. And they saw that first wave of populism. History doesn't repeat, but it sure as heck rhymes. This is pure populism. That they saw that populism. And they said, maybe I can be the next one. Don't think for a second that John C. Calhoun didn't see himself. He was very open that he saw himself as positioned for the next president. James Buchanan disagreed with Andrew Jackson early in his career, but saw him as a ticket to go on there. Same thing with Martin Van Buren. Little Martin Van Buren. I forget what they had a term they used. I think it was Little Martin Van Buren, but some of that. All those guys were just trying to ride this old, cantankerous, anti-constitutional, fake war hero. They were trying to ride his coattails. Mm-hmm. And instead, exactly, they accused what they were doing to John Quincy Adams, arguably the most moral man ever to be president. And unfortunately, this would cover all the way to the election of 1828, which I know we covered last episode. It would follow all the way through this Jacksonian populism all the way to 1828. And you'd see these same unscrupulous men do the same thing and slander and berate and rip down the most moral president we've ever had. They would somehow turn somebody who was like hated trappings, somebody who liked to eat, his favorite meal was crackers, like crackers and cheese is his favorite meal. His favorite thing to do in the morning was to swim naked in the Potomac. Like, who liked to farm and write letters, right? And they would go on to slander and berate this man. They'd make up lies while ignoring the actual horrible things that their president would do. And they would beat him in 1828. Not because they ran a better campaign. It's because Adams refused to lower the presidency. And you know what? Unfortunately, the presidency got lowered dramatically across the next nine presidents until Abraham Lincoln gets elected.
It goes for a while. And then after Lincoln, there was another big stretch.
Another big switch. I mean, realistically, who you go from Jackson to Lincoln. You can't point out any good president right there. I mean, there are some presidents that have interesting things they've done, but it was this systematic Jacksonian populism that ended that basically caused the Civil War. Slavery caused the Civil War. But that lit the match for the Civil War. So you had this idea of this anti-morality, this pro-slavery, you know, everybody trying to pretend to be a Jackson for the next 9 presidents. And it's like, wait, that's the guy you model after? Well, the sequel's never good as the original. The original was pretty awful to begin with. My blood pressure is horrible.
Well, let's wrap this up then. Let's do some rankings so we can maybe end on a happy note. Like, where do you think your boy John Quincy Adams is gonna fall on our Rushmore scale?
Can we just do 7 across the board? This man deserves way more love. He deserves a state named after him, not just a county in Illinois.
Anyway, let's review the POTUS scale here real quick. Give it a quick summary here. So we're going to rank a scale of 1 to 7 on political influence, overall governance, transformational leadership, understanding of public needs, and strategic vision. So do you want to kick us off with some political influence? How do you think John did at shaping the political landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts?
Yeah, so he's probably
this is going to be his weakest one, I would assume.
Yeah, he's probably a 2. Let's say he's a 2.
That low?
Yeah, because...
You think he was worse than your boy John Adams?
Oh, yeah. Because the Federalists
existed,
and they weren't that successful afterwards, but he barely belonged to political parties. And
yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, you're being honest so far, so...
I'm being honest.
Right. Overall governance, administration's implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability and governance.
Well, here's the thing. Despite Congress being against him, he oversaw it very stable.
Yeah, I was going to actually make that argument, too.
Yeah.
I mean, considering that he had somebody actively trying to sabotage his entire presidency.
Yeah, so I think he gets top marks for stability.
Okay.
I think if we look at, you know, his ability to understand what the nation needed, I think that's a 7. Like, we need a strong navy and we need highways.
Oh, he knew everything we needed, and we proved that out because they went and did everything after him. He just couldn't get it done while he was there. What about transformational leadership, then? The ability to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history? Did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change? He did try.
I want to say he did. He had the ideas that he proposed.
The Panama deal where he sent... Oh, I mean, he did the force Nicaraguan, the issues.
The Nicaraguan canal. He proposed building a canal across Nicaragua.
Oh, really?
Before, obviously, 100 years before the Panama... Not 100, but 75 years before the Panama Canal.
Huh, no kidding.
Yeah. I'm going to give him a 6. Do not screw it. I'm giving him a 6. I can't help it if there is a bunch of horrible people in Congress that stop my boy from passing all the amazing ideas that he had.
I want to ding you one more, but I'll give you that one. You gave him such a low score in political influence that I'll let you have the 6 there. What about his strategic vision?
7.
Clarity and ambition to the vision for the country? That's got to be a 7, yeah.
No other president was like, we should have a Department of the Interior. We should build canals. We should be friends with South America. We should have national universities. We should have a naval academy. Just 7. He was right about everything. He was just right about everything.
So that gives him a score of 29. That puts him pretty high up there. I think that puts him number 3 now on our Mount Rushmore.
I'm a fan.
I think he's number 3. Washington at 31, and I think Monroe is at 30.
God, yeah, Monroe did great.
Damn. I'm glad that these are working out the way we hoped. You are in charge of scoring them, so obviously they're going to reflect that somewhat.
To me, Eric's 4 favorite presidents, who Eric doesn't agree with.
I swear to God, if Teddy Roosevelt's at the bottom of the list, I'm going to be pissed.
he's going to be a fun one, too, because he's good. Well, actually, he's an interesting cat, dude. He is so interesting. His presidency is probably one of the most transformative presidencies ever. If you remove his, like, cultural impact, and you remove everything around him, and just look at the 10 years he was president, because he served for a couple of years under McKinley, McKinley was assassinated, he's going to be cool, man. Think of America from McKinley to Taft, how much it changed.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to be cool. I know we often talk about the presidents I'm not going to enjoy doing. And I'm not one of those like guys who's super fan of Theodore Roosevelt. I think he has some shortcomings. But man, it's going to be hard to not be like, this dude was awesome.
He's very progressive for the time. I think just for that, like I was a huge fan. Not to mention all the parks.
Yeah, all the parks. Oh, the Department of Interior. Who would have thought of that idea?
Right. All right. But anyway, I do have to wrap this thing up here. So this is actually closing out the season one, I think. This is going to put an end to our revolutionary period, I think.
Yeah.
Like we've been calling it. So when we come back from this one, we're probably going to do a couple of just bonus episodes, maybe some recap ones. We haven't quite figured out what those are going to be yet. I think the next thing that'll be coming out is just so we can have a break is just going to be a compilation of all the cut submarine material that we've had. So be on the lookout for that one. If you've got any other ideas or suggestions or things that you want us to cover, please shoot us a message. BuckStartsHerePodcast@gmail.com, or you just drop a comment in one of the episodes, either on Spotify or YouTube, wherever you're getting them.
Journals. Email us to get your journal. Top of the first 10 people. I cannot wait to get these designed. I'm very excited about this.
Yeah. Shoot us a message. First 10, I think you said, right?
Yeah, first 10.
All right. Now, also hit the website on your way up. Buck Starts Here Podcast. Sub on your favorite platforms to stay up to date. And we'll see you all soon. Bye.
Bye.
Produced by China Shop Productions.